Thank you. So for those of you who stuck around for the afternoon, I'm giving you a little eye candy to finish off the day. I noticed that we all, in the afternoon, or most of us, used a black background with white text, which as a visual person I think is kind of interesting, since this is sort of a birthday celebration, but anyway. So I am the archivist for digital collections at the Bancroft Library, which is sort of an interesting title. Because as I said, I was telling Gene that I'm not an archivist, but I play one on TV. So I've actually been with the Bancroft for 12 years. I am now the head of the digital collections unit, and I'll tell you a little bit about what we do in a minute. But prior to that, I worked in museums, and I focused on art documentation, digitization, and art conservation. So I kind of come from a very different field, in a way, but from a field that I really craved standards. And when I got to the library and archives, I just went, oh my God, you know, hallelujah. So here I've stayed. In the past, I've done a lot of work on metadata standards, descriptive guidelines, things like that. Such as the RLG guidelines for descriptive metadata. I've worked on the cataloging cultural objects, content standard, mods, etc. And I'm currently on the OAC redesign working group, so for the Online Archive of California. Okay. So I titled my talk Archival Description in the Network Age, but it really doesn't focus at all, I think, on what I'm going to talk about. So disregard that. But really, I just want to talk about how access, the networked age, is affecting access to our archival description and sort of a different way of looking at that. So as I said, I'm the archivist for digital collections, and I approach this through the lens of a person who focuses on EAD and digital object encoding, maintenance, and presentation. I don't do traditional archival description. We have fabulous archivists, one of whom is sitting right back here, James Eason, who work on our archival collections. So I am the one who, once they are done with their description, I get to move it online. So that's really my job. So I've been working with EAD for over 10 years. I started in 1996, a little bit before. So I have a long relationship with the standard. So that's kind of my background. But one of the things I've noticed in my job is that we're always moving forward. With each digital initiative that we've worked on, we've tried to do something better. We've tried to improve access. We've tried to make more of our materials available online. And as a community, I think, and as I've seen over and over throughout the talks today, is that even if we're looking backward, we're trying to look forward. And keeping our eye on that road ahead is a really good thing, and I'm glad we're taking pause to do that today. So, as I began to reflect on the issues that we face now and on into the future in archival description and access, I found myself focusing on the access portion of it. While we have some challenges coming up, certainly, as I do specifically, in electronic and born digital records and making those available, one of our greatest challenges going forward is providing access to our collections, both physically and virtually. We're addressing the physical access primarily with the help of the well-known principles put out by Green and Meisner, which have been mentioned several times today. And many institutions, including the Bancroft, are taking these principles and putting them into practice and making a dent on those infamous backlogs. But as Elizabeth Yackel posited so simply yesterday, the finding aid isn't the thing. Which I thought was a really nice, simple statement. But to me, more importantly, if I can get this to go forward, access is the thing. Focusing on the finding aid is one thing, but really I think we should be focusing a lot on access. As both Elizabeth in her session and Mark Green in his plenary address argued, our job is to provide access to the collections to put users in touch with collections. So to go a little bit beyond that, to me also, access is online, and it's all happening online. The most provocative statement I'll probably say today is that if Green and Meisner percentage on how many people have implemented EAD and are putting finding aids online, we have to increase adoption of EAD and increase our ability to digitize archival materials and put them online. We have a number of forces at work right now. We are in a sphere of networked information. There's a growing desire by users to not only find description online, but also to find digital versions of the materials they seek. We have to consider the forces, blame it on Google, Open Content Alliance, other instant gratification sites, but more and more we're expected not only to provide online description of archival materials, but also access to digital versions of them. And is this, and this is really the environment we're faced with. I absolutely love this, and I have to say courtesy to one of my good friends and colleagues, Gunter Weibel, for a few of his slides, which I snatched out of our Syracuse, we teach a graduate course in Syracuse on digital collections, and I snapped some of his slides, so, but I did credit him. But this map shows the London Underground with networked sites that are mapped according to popularity and use. And in the interest of kind of a visualization, I think this very clearly illustrates how much competition there is for our users' attention. What can we do to insert ourselves into this environment? Our users are at this level, and we, to some degree, or to whatever degree we can, need to meet them out here. And this is sort of, I could look at both sides of this. Can we do it? Can we meet? Should we meet them out here or not? And that's kind of an open question as we move into the future. But first we need to get our information and digital materials online. And as with our processing backlogs, the problem with digitization in libraries and archives is that we still have so much to do. The Digitization Matters Forum, held in the 2007 SAA, as outlined in the resulting report, Shifting Gears, Gearing Up to Get in the Flow, indicated that the same is true for many other special collections. The situation is a result of a concatenation of circumstances, including high standards for digital capture, a focus on high quality and lengthy description, often to the item level for anything we digitize, as well as weighty standard guidelines set by aggregators, funders, and by institutions themselves. Thus far, the high cost of digitization has limited the amount of content that can be digitized and has fostered the creation of a proportionately small body of materials that are highly selective in nature. As our user population becomes more online as opposed to in person, part of our mission is shifting toward meeting their online needs and expectations. For serious researchers and users of special collections, coming into the institution will always be desirable, but they also expect to be able to do a good deal of their preliminary seeking and finding online. So it's becoming even more important that we find ways to get our information and resources out to these online users to facilitate their work and thereby meet our mission. So where do we start? The one place to look at is a model that provides us a roadmap, and here it is. See, I'm jumping forward, there we go. Yeah, sorry, Green and Meisner. The Green and Meisner principles are rather straightforward in nature. Find ways to break down traditional practices that are creating roadblocks to access. Identify areas where efficiencies can be implemented to reduce costs and get more work done using fewer resources. And basically get over having to do it right or to perfection every time. The fairly rapid adoption of these principles in the archival processing field indicates that the time's right for change. And this is evident in numerous reports pointing to the broader shift in bibliographic services, preservation strategies, and access models in libraries, museums, and archives. The now familiar tenets, principles for change of the Green and Meisner Report, have greatly influenced our archival processing going forward, and I, as the Archivist for Digital Collections, have also seen the wisdom and necessity of applying these principles to the work we're doing in digitizing those archives. And I want to show you my co-opted principles, or tenets, of the Green and Meisner. So as archives move in the direction of providing less detailed description for more materials, we too have to find ways to use fewer resources to digitize more materials. So we need to maximize user access, which is a preeminent goal for both of us, but good enough digitization is realistic. Arrange, describe, and digitize at a common level, or common aggregate level. Reserve exceptional digitization effort when only warranted, and accomplish more digitization by trying to do less. And unfortunately, Dennis isn't here, but I told him I was showing this slide. So he thought it was pretty interesting. Anyway, but as with implementing these principles in archival processing, there are issues and concerns we need to grapple with. And as we move in this direction, and it is a direction we're moving in, I wanted to share some of the ideas we're exploring. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a background on how we're trying to increase archival description, or description, sorry, digitization. So just a couple of projects. We actually started doing this back in 2003. We looked at how we could, as our funding started to dry up for digital projects done to the, you know, the boutique level, or very high-end level, how could we start digitizing more inexpensively and on a broader scale? And the first project we did was a George and Phoebe Apperson Hearst papers. It was a newly created or newly microfilmed collection. Had targets present, and we did about 4,000 frames from the microfilm at 50 cents a frame. Well, we've been digitizing at $20 to $25 a shot on any other item in our collection, so this was a huge shift in cost. And we did folder-level digital objects. And here's the digital object on the OAC, and unfortunately you can't see this, but this first shot is actually the folder. It's on a microfilm, so it's there in the digital object. And so we grouped everything in the folder so that users would really have that experience of walking in, requesting a folder, opening it, and seeing what the contents were. So we thought this is sort of a reading room-like experience. Then you can see that there's a lot of metadata. We didn't add any additional metadata to these objects. The description came right out of the finding aid. So these are just folder-level descriptions, dates, and we added the collection number as well as the collection, a link to the actual full finding aid and our institution to each digital object. These are all METS objects. These are linked within the finding aid themselves, but they can also be searched independently. And here you can see one of the items, and the title just says item one. And then they can get a close-up view. So these were done as bitonal images, and we weren't super happy with the results, but it was a first attempt to try and get this done really cheaply, and it was great. You can see fairly good quality on the handwritten stuff, and again, these are handwritten, so we wouldn't be able to OCR these, but you would eventually want to OCR anything that's printed. Okay, so we've moved on to other microfilm projects. We're doing Bancroft dictations, again, all handwritten materials. We've done 16,000 pages. Gene Gehagen, who's in the back of the room, is working on the NDNP project for us. We are the technical lead for the California State project, which is being done with UCR. We are also embarking on a new project with the Muir letters, which were also microfilm. So we're doing a lot with microfilm. And what's changed since 2003 is the price is dropping. It's now down to 30 cents a frame. Specifications are stabilizing based on mostly the NDNP, National Digital Newspaper Project, specifications. And also, the microfilm is a traditional workflow we've all used for our collection, so there's no real huge leap for us to send our stuff out to be microfilmed. They digitize. They can digitize and create the film for you, or they can create the film and then digitize it for you. They can also create digital color images. As in the same workflow they do microfilm. So you have a lot of options, and when people talk about, oh my God, how are we going to digitize archival materials, we have a model. It's now gone digital. So it's a really great one to look at. We also are doing some mass digitization of our archival materials, again, using microfilm. And this is just one example, the Archives of California. And I wanted to show you how different these looked when we did them as grayscale. The quality is quite good. Here's the first page. This is a 487, this is a reel full of microfilm, so they haven't broken it up yet. But the quality is very good. You can even see some of the qualities in the paper that was captured. And very fine details in the handwriting aren't lost when you do the grayscale. In fact, when you dupe at very low contrast, it improves OCR results, is what we found with an NDNP report project. So these are some of the ways we're dealing with our archival collections, our manuscript collections, excuse me. But we also have a lot of image collections, negative collections in particular, and we've been doing these at an aggregate level, again, not providing any additional description. And this is from the Call Bulletin Archive. This is a sleeve level. These are sleeves that have information on them, and then there could be anywhere from 1 to 100 negatives within that sleeve. We create the metadata, which is fairly extensive, based on the finding aid, and it's at the sleeve level, and then we do aggregate groupings, scanning everything in. So you can see there's a lovely picture of Martin Luther King. Well, that's at the aggregate grouping, but it's not on this particular image. So we've had some comments about that. The users were a little upset that the title of this piece is negative. But it's up there, and if you query Martin Luther King, you will find it. So we're partway there, but maybe not perfect. Okay, and then our most recent project is the Examiner Archive, a very big one, 6 million images. We're doing a pilot to think about doing low resolution, again, same model, using what's in the finding aid, using what's on the sleeve, and doing these aggregate groupings. Most of the materials are something like this, and so do we want to be putting a whole lot of descriptive effort into images of little kids with doggies? I don't know. She's really cute, but you know, what do we want to do with this? The other thing, we are also attempting to do low-res scans, and what we ended up finding is we were doing what are considered our presentation level scans, but they're for online use. They're great. They're fairly high quality. We don't have to go to the highest level of the standards that we generally follow. But what we actually found when we went out to a vendor, and we're using vendors for all this work. We are not doing this in-house. The vendors came back and said, oh, well, we can do those low ones for the same as the high res, so same price. So we're finding these vendors are you know, getting really savvy about doing this kind of work. So good thing to look at. But we have some other issues with creating these digital objects kind of without additional description than what actually exists. And here's a picture, and I don't know if you guys can read that, but this is a barroom brawl. And in these projects, we'll scan not only the negatives and the negative sleeves. We're scanning the negative sleeves and the negatives, and our hope is that we can either OCR or have transcribed the images of these sleeves into metadata records. But there are a lot of people's names on those. And if we don't go through and think about what we're putting up, I mean, there are pictures of domestic violence with people named. They followed rape victims into the hospital and photographed them and typed their names on these sleeves. So there's a lot of really, personal information that might be put out there that we're not sure we want to do. So that's a little troubling, and sort of, again, questions whether this minimal processing and trying to do things quick and getting things out there is really the best thing we can do. So we're looking at different ways to address this, and we haven't really come to any specific answers yet. So how are we doing all this? And I think this was touched on by a few of us, but it's really important to look at what are our tools to do this sort of digitization. And creation of EAD finding aids and try and get more of these documents out online. Archivist Toolkit, I'm sure all of you have heard about the Archon. These are open source software tools that provide some level of collection management as well as creation of EAD and METS digital objects. They're open source, which means you need to implement them, but there are some support structures sort of in place that are moving forward. Another one that's interesting is OpenCollections/CollectionSpace, which is a Mellon-funded project that's actually being run in New York, Toronto, and Berkeley simultaneously. And they're developing a collection management system for museums, libraries, and archives, and have actually been talking to the folks at AT about maybe, you know, pulling in that EAD METS part as part of their tool as well, because they're both Mellon-funded open source projects. So that's one to look at. And then there's the MOAC Community Toolbox, which is a METS-only creation tool, but this is why it says open up there, because it's often referred to as open source, but it's not. It's a FileMaker database. But it's a free tool that's out there and available. The others are actual open source projects, really true open source. And this is really just a free tool you can get to make METS objects, but it only makes METS objects. So there are a lot of tools out there that we could look at. There's also commercial tools that are available, ContentDM is one that you can do digital objects in, and actually there is a migration path to get METS out of that and get EAD out of that. So there's some really interesting tools out there, and I think what the tools are going to do is free us from the encoding burdens and impose some consistency in the way we're marking up finding aids and digital objects, and really will help us get EAD finding aids and digital content online more easily. And so as we create more, what sort of access models do we want to consider? Here are some traditional venues for digital object sharing, and I apologize again, this is one of Gunter's slides that I had to grab because I didn't have a slide, for all the different types of these sharing, these aggregations that are out there. You see OAC up there, but Northwest Digital Archive should be up there, and CDP, and a bunch of other different kinds of venues that we can put all of our stuff together. But there's also some, and these are really just silos, but these were the first step in getting us over the hurdle of sharing our data that was, as Gene talked about, structured metadata. So getting them into these is the first hurdle. But then there's some new stuff going on. The Flickr implementations from the Library of Congress. January 16, 2008, Flickr put up their stuff. This goes out to that network level and starts looking at where users are. And one of the, here's some color images. And within 24 hours of putting that up, this is how many views they had. We had almost 400,000 views, 650,000 views of photos. 420 photos have been commented on, and a lot of them were commented on by experts in that particular subject area. And again, these are Gunter's slides, so I have to thank him for these. But this was pretty phenomenal. This was a first, real attempt to put stuff out where the users are. A lot of the comments were really good, but again, a lot of them were just like, hey, this is really cool. So, but the nice thing about this is the comments are removed from LC. So they're happening in a different venue, a venue that's not authoritative. So it kind of makes that okay. And they can bring in comments, and they have, in fact, brought in comments and changed some of their records based on these responses. So it's an interesting experiment. And we're not the only community, the library is not the only community that's doing this. The Powerhouse Museum, and these are Flickr Commons, Brooklyn Museum, and Smithsonian are all starting to do this, and the whole Flickr Commons is really looking at trying to get cultural institutions to put their images and possibly other kinds of content, digital content, in these venues. And I think that's pretty exciting. There also are, the user-contributed metadata is pretty interesting, and pushing our data out there so to other social tagging sites is, again, somewhat safe, but do we really want to be active in these social spaces? Because we might need to respond in some cases. This was brought up yesterday. Do we want to be responsible for maintaining those kinds of relationships in that kind of a social space, or do we want to sit back? Now, again, these are open questions. Another thing is, something we were talking about, Wikipedia, putting links to our finding aids in Wikipedia is another way to reach out to users where they are. So that's another interesting idea. You guys are going to love this slide. Okay, so one of the things we need to do is get over controlling what our users do with our collections. And this is kind of like, we're always afraid to put the cookie jar within reach. And this is what we're doing when we go out in those social spaces. They're going to mess with our stuff. They're going to, what was it, something, they circled a face on our Japanese relocation photograph by Dorothea Lange and said something about emo kids, Oh, okay, which is some different group. I'm not sure what emo is, but it, sorry, showing my age. That was you. Yeah. So, anyway, this is all a major hurdle that we have to get over if we want to start putting our stuff in social spaces and dealing with that social space. So that's good. I'm going to try and finish up now. So what does all this tell us about our future? I think it tells us that we need to find alternative ways to develop digital collections and get them online. We have to look at options. We need to find cheaper, better methods for putting materials out in digital form. And we need to share all those methods with our researchers. Yesterday, the More Pixels session talked a lot about user studies, and I thought that was really great because we've done a lot of this work without doing any user studies. We've just been trying to figure out how to do it and do it really cheaply and efficiently and all that. So I think we really need to understand what users expect. one of the user studies pointed to, at the University of Wisconsin, pointed to the fact that users were more than willing to come into an institution and sit and look through a folder of materials in person without any item level description. But when faced with that same folder of materials online, they wanted item level description. They expected it. So their online expectations are different from their in-person expectations. So that's something we have to think about and start looking at. Well, what does this mean? Can we not expect the same behavior from an online user that we can from a walk-in-the-door user? So we have a couple of difficult next steps, and these are more, I guess, my provocativist comments, or more provocative comments. We need to do a lot of this stuff. We need to start putting some effort towards this and not always relying on grant funding to do it. And that means taking money from other things and putting it towards this sort of effort. That's going to hurt. We're going to take work away from other things. But maybe if we're providing less description or archival, we can move some of that effort over to describing digital objects and getting those done cheaply. I don't know. That's something we are going to have to balance. We're going to have to balance where we put our money and what we're going to provide to users and start figuring most of this online stuff out, because I think that's where we're going. So in terms of predicting the future, as one of a political pundit said on NPR this week, I'm not good at predicting the future, which I thought was really straightforward and clear, you know, and personally I think none of us should seriously try. But if I had to say from my experience in this ever-changing and evolving field, where we'll be moving in the next 10 years is increasingly towards a digital world, and where everything or most everything's online, and if it's not, it will be passed over for those things that are. So our users will be there too, and we better be ready to meet them there or decide why we don't want to. So that's it, and thank you very much.